The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
John Gibbons, we've decided to put on a little bit earlier than usual. Cal Thomas and Mary McKeown will be with us next afterwards. But John, one of the reasons that we asked you to start was because after all the fuss about Hurricane Milton in recent days, it didn't turn out to be that bad after all, did it?
Yeah, good evening, Matt. It sort of did a bit of a pivot as it was coming towards, I think, Tampa, and sort of avoided probably what would have been the worst incident in Tampa Bay in a century. So that's the luck of the draw, really, with hurricanes. Even their formation is quite mysterious. Any meteorologist will tell you that. It's a sort of an arcane secret sauce that comes together to create the exact conditions at the exact moment for a hurricane. So there's a huge amount of uncertainty in how they form. There's also uncertainty in the paths that they take. But what we do know in the case of Milton is that, I mean, it was a monster. It started out in the Gulf of Mexico as really a Category 1. It built up energy up to Category 4. It peaked out at about 250 kilometres, like wind speeds of 250 kilometres an hour. And then as it approached land, the normal pattern for hurricanes is that they lose energy as they travel over land because they suck up their energy from the heat in the water. And as you know, you need surface water temperatures of at least 26 degrees to basically provide the fuel for hurricanes. That's why we don't, for example, have hurricanes off the coast of Ireland. Well, hopefully I'll be able to say that in the future too. That's what's required. So the temperature that the water travelled over in the Gulf of Mexico to fuel Milton and indeed Helene 2 weeks ago is 30.5 degrees surface temperature, which is basically like a warm bath. And that is the fuel. That is providing fuel. So, and I think...
There is a problem here though, John, isn't there? In that if you can look at the science and you can see that hurricanes form 4 to 5 times more often now than they used to because of that warmer water in that region, and that more of them are reaching landfall. But when you have this sort of the apocalyptic descriptions of what's going to happen and it doesn't happen, you then get the sceptics who will say, sure, listen to everyone who is banging on about the damage, and sure, these hurricanes are no worse than they used to be 100 years ago.
Sure. If we go back, say, to 2005, Hurricane Katrina, that obviously did devastating damage in New Orleans. There was a lot of skepticism, even media skepticism, about Katrina because, again, meteorologists, forecasters, they have to sort of err on the side of caution, Matt, because of the variable and erratic nature of these phenomena. They're trying to study it. And of course, you're studying a live phenomenon. It's literally unfolding on screens in front of you. You're sending up aircraft.
And it's uncontrollable.
It's totally uncontrollable. And again, you know, we hear this nonsense about weather modification and stuff, but just so people understand, an average hurricane's life cycle is reckoned to have the energy of about 10,000 nuclear bombs. These are immensely powerful natural phenomena. So the notion of somebody controlling them or moving them around from one area of the state to the other is completely ridiculous. In the same way, you might recall a previous US president some time back suggesting a way to defuse hurricanes would be to explode a nuclear weapon over them.
Right? Which one was that?
I can't remember the name. I think it began with a T, but it's completely gone out of my head. But this is the kind of crazyville that
And you have people, prominent Republicans, who are essentially claiming that somehow the Democrats were influencing how these storms were gathering and where they'd go.
That's right. Marjorie Taylor Greene, to name one, claims again that the Dems are manipulating the weather. And it's often been said that when a hurricane hits a blue state, it's because God hates gays. But when a hurricane hits a red state, it's because the Democrats are controlling the weather. So this is this era that we've unfortunately found ourselves in of sort of misinformation and counter-truth, where essentially anybody can put any counterfactual into the public domain. And then using, for example, Elon Musk as a classic case in point, he's amping up a lot of this nonsense is now being boosted through Twitter. And again, ordinary people who don't necessarily have access to expert information, this is what they see and this is what they believe. And you can't stop people believing things that are not true.
So it's sort of the worst of both worlds, in the sense that if it isn't as disastrous as we feared it was going to be, there are people who are going to say, you shouldn't be giving us those warnings. And then the next one that comes along, if there's another one in a couple of weeks' time, and if because of that the warnings aren't given, and suddenly it does turn out to be an absolute disaster, the very people who deny deny climate change. You'll be going, you should have told us this was going to happen. You didn't give us the opportunity to escape it.
That's right. Unfortunately, the politicization of weather is such an incredibly dangerous thing. For example, Trump, again, in the run into the US election, he's been trying to use the FEMA's response to Hurricane Helene as a political weapon, claiming that the federal government, in other words, that Biden and Harris failed to intervene. This is the same guy, of course, who defunded FEMA a few years back. How quickly we forget. But that is unfortunately the atmosphere in which we operate. It's probably important to say, Matt, as well, we're less than 30 days out from the US election, so paranoia is spiking at all-time highs. And when a hurricane tracks through your county or your electoral district, you can understand how these type of rumours are absolutely sweeping around.
Okay, well, you know, we'll get to Cal in just a little while and ask him what he thinks of Paradise Regained, as it may be now, as Hurricane Milton didn't do the damage expected. Let's come back to Ireland, though, for a moment. National parks are to get legal status and management plans after years of neglect. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is an interesting one, Matt. We have 8 national parks in Ireland. And when I say national park, I suppose most people would envisage this area of pristine wildlife and thriving nature. In fact, our national parks are nothing of the sort. They're what are called paper parks. They have this official designation. But if you say, well, okay, what can't happen in a national park? For example, can sheep graze in a national park? And the answer is yeah. All our national parks are overrun with sheep grazing. They've got goats grazing. We have out-of-control deer grazing in all our national parks.
But is that not natural part of nature?
Not even remotely, no. I mean, when you have tens, hundreds of thousands of herbivores and nobody managing them, as in no carnivores, no predators to manage these, what you get basically is chaos. And also we've seen this particularly in our upland national parks, mountain areas that are completely ruined. There isn't a single tree or a blade of grass, a bush much taller than 6 inches tall, because they've been grazed to the ground. And people often, and you see areas like Connemara, Matt, and Wicklow, and people drive up there and they go, my God, this is magnificent. Ireland, look how beautiful it is. Look how bleak and barren it is. That's because the sheep and the deer have eaten all the vegetation. If you actually see areas in Ireland, for example, there's the very occasional island in the middle of a lake, and you look at it and you go, oh my God, it's completely covered in dense foliage, tall trees and undergrowth. And you say, well, how come it's in the island? And the short answer is, sheep are not very good swimmers. That's why. Right?
Okay, Ireland has 8 national parks. There's the Wicklow Mountains National Park, there's Glen Vey, Bruinne Bwina, Killarney National Park, which is probably the one I would know best, Park na Síonta na Mara Cúrí, the Burren, Connemara and Wild Nefyn, Bruinne Bwina in County Meath, and Park na Síonta na Mara Cúrí, or the Kerry Seas National Park, have only been established in the last year.
And the plan here basically is, right now, as I say, these are what are called paper parks, right? They have no real designation of a plan. What are the rules? Who can use them? Who can't use them? So it's basically open season. So what Minister Noonan is trying to establish here is to get the public involved and say, what do you want from your national parks? And to give us the basis then into next year, and hopefully the next government will take this on, whether or not there's a green component in it. Because national parks, by the way, should be for the nation. They should be a national treasure for all of us, not just a convenience for people.
So are you saying, would you ban sheep, goats and other animals from the national parks?
Absolutely. In most cases, they need to be absolutely controlled
and
from
is,
them.
Is that easily done?
Well, I mean, again, like so many of these things, these are things we've chickened out on, we've funked around them, right? We know, for example, that we need to restrict the access of grazers in order to allow native vegetation to take hold. And this has huge value, Matt, to the rest of us. You might say, actually, what's a mountain? You might as well stick a few sheep up on it, right? Somebody making a bob. First of all, people, sheep farmers, aren't making money. They only subsist on subsidies from the rest of us, number one. We'd be far better off paying them to be custodians of the mountains. Now, you might say, well, what's that mountain? What use is that mountain to me? A mountain with its natural vegetation intact has one. It has many brilliant functions, apart from carbon sequestration and for biodiversity. The other great thing, Matt, that it does is it prevents rainfall and flooding cascading down and destroying our towns and villages. So we should be paying farmers and other landowners to let the mountains and the uplands regenerate so that they will form a flood defence.
Tell us about the analysis the World Wildlife Fund has done on the Earth's wildlife populations.
Yeah, I've been tracking this for a number of years, and essentially this is called the Living Planet Index. It's work done between the WWF and the Zoological Society of London. So they track about 5,500 index species. Now, this is right across the board. This includes amphibians, birds, fish, mammals and reptiles. So what they're trying to do is to establish not outright extinction, but the numbers of each species. So what we've found is that in the period from 1970 to 2020, 50-year period, freshwater species around the world have declined in number by 85%. Terrestrial species by 69%, marine species by 56%. So the put that all together and you get an overall, what they call a catastrophic decline.
That's an extraordinary number. So what is killing, or why are these numbers falling? Is this just pollution going into our water, which is killing all of these fish and other various wildlife?
The number one pressure on every other species on Earth is human activities. Sorry to say it, that's just the basic fact. We are pressing into and consuming and expanding our footprint into the natural world. We're tearing down rainforests, we're converting land for agricultural use, for timber, for forestry use and so on. And this, of course, means obliterating the habitats of these wildlife. When you cut down a native rainforest, the species that are finely tuned to that environment, they can't just move, pack up their bags and go down the road. Basically, they're finished. You're committing them to extinction. But it's an incredible thing, Matt, to think that from the time that, I don't know about you, but say the time I started primary school in 1970, there's a bit of a giveaway. That was the year I started primary school.
So did I.
Yeah. So from that year to this, right, we have lost 3/4 of all the vertebrate life on Earth. In the time that I started primary school to being here with you today, it is an incredible thought. Nothing in history, and I don't mean human history, in Earth history, short of a meteor strike, has ever caused such a devastating loss of life on this planet. And that's why people who track this thing, I mean, by the way, we're not even talking about climate change here today for a change. I mean, what we're talking about is human impacts, the massive human footprint that is crushing the natural world underneath our feet, taking away from the natural world its ability to function by sequestering the land, by turning nature into what we call resources, Matt. And we use those resources to build what we call the economy. As our human economy gets bigger and bigger, the natural world declines and gets smaller and smaller. It'll reach a certain point when the natural world collapses, and sad to say, it will take the human world and our economy down with it.
Look, just one other one. Tell us about the British government pledging nearly £22 billion sterling for carbon capture projects. Is that the type of thing now that you'd celebrate?
Absolutely not. No, this is a shocking move from a Prime Minister who continues to disappoint on a daily and a weekly basis. I mean, I do not know what this...
Keir Starmer.
I mean, I don't know. Don't get me started, as they say, Matt. But let's just stick with this one. CCS basically means carbon capture and storage. This is this magical solution, which, by the way, the only real people who've been touting CCS are the fossil fuel industry. What they're saying is, oh, sure, we'll just continue to pollute, we'll continue to burn stuff, and sure, we'll capture it and we'll store it. Now, this has been tried. Taxpayers have put billions of euros into investment in CCS technologies around the world. None of them have been brought to operate at commercial scale. But they'll take your money. Meanwhile, for some reason completely unknown, Starmer has decided to double down on CCS in Britain. It's absolutely shocking. If the Tories did this, you'd say, well, what do you expect? But it really is. It's hands in the air time. But essentially, what we know is that as long as you continue with the idea of CCS, that means you don't set a date at which you phase out oil, gas and coal. And this is the key issue. Also, Matt, as a quick point on this, Britain has actually phased out coal production. And the only area where CCS is even remotely effective is in scrubbing carbon from coal burning facilities. So basically, Starmer hasn't even done his homework on this.
Thank you very much, John Gibbons.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.